This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
This week, Chris sent out a little questionnaire asking your opinions, for your suggestions regarding any modification in our weekly schedule, whether it would be more convenient to meet at some different times. And that may seem like a small thing to ask, but it's actually a very big deal. I do not imagine that the abbot of Gethsemane would send out a questionnaire to the monks, you know, asking if they'd rather not get up at 3:15 in the morning, or, you know, having recited the Psalms every day for their entire life, they're getting tired of it, would prefer a different text. There are some aspects of monastic tradition that by virtue of being a tradition simply are not up for grabs, they're not up for discussion, and any modifications to the rituals or schedules or practices would be very rare and undertaken with a great deal of seriousness and solemnity. Practicing as we do in a lay center, trying to integrate our practice into our life, trying to create a schedule of sitting and talks and teaching that actually can fit into people's lives is a different kind of matter. When you set up a monastic form of life, the idea is that people leave everything behind in order to enter that life and conform to its structure. And part of the practice is surrendering to that structure. It's going into a world where your personal sense of comfort or convenience or likes or dislikes is largely irrelevant. And the assumption is that in some very important and basic way, your life has been tyrannized precisely by your own will, precisely by your own likes and dislikes and attachments. And if you don't like what's going on, well, so much the better. The schedule is intentionally a kind of grindstone meant to relentlessly wear down your sense of preference and attachment and having it your way. This is a powerful kind of practice, and it, of course, can go well or badly. One can surrender to that all-encompassing practice and have a great sense of liberation from self. Or one can merely submit to the authority and routine of the practice and come away resigned and depressed. One size does not fit all. But we're in this middle position of both inheriting a form of practice and by necessity having to modify it or adapt it to the lives of the people who come here to practice it. And we have to in some way be very careful what we do and what we decide. I've been reading a very interesting book by Eric Ries on 19th century utopian experiments in this country. And these were variously either radical religious communities like the Shaker or early forms of socialist utopias like New Harmony. But what they had in common was a sense that they could reinvent society from scratch. That they would really start with some kind of blank slate and say, what's an ideal way to live? And depending on the vision of the founder, that ideal either had to do with worship, or it had to do with work, or both, had to do with what is valued, how commodities and labor of ordinary people are to be valued in a community, how work is to be distributed, how goods are to be distributed. And the various founders were sometimes quite brilliant and charismatic people. But the lesson in one way or another is that even though they came up with many ideas that carried forward into society at large over the years, for instance, things like the notion of a public school really originated in New Harmony, things like that. The idea that education should be free and available to all was a radical notion, one we take for granted now. But one kind of lesson of these communities is that any attempt to operate as if you had a blank slate in which to operate, that you could start from scratch and create an ideal society, always faltered and constantly unforeseen conflicts and consequences of the ideal programs they had. And this was the sort of thing that was writ large in revolutions. I mean, it was the thinking of the French Revolution, that they were going to throw out the old order, destroy it, root and branch, get rid of kings and priests, start completely afresh. You know, this is the ideal of Rousseau. But it quickly became the program of a Robespierre, and the attempt to create revolutionary societies from scratch, to reorganize them from the top down after some visionary's picture, the implementation of these things has gotten just worse and worse as we move into the 20th century and go from Robespierre to Mao and Stalin and Pol Pot. No, I don't think Chris is intending anything quite that radical. But we have to think carefully about to what extent we make choices and structure things here. What we just chanted at the opening of this talk said that this Dharma, so rarely encountered, is something that we now hold and maintain. And I think that the meaning of that, in a way, is two-sided, because we are charged to hold and maintain this Dharma, in that we are its bearers, its manifestation here and now. This is what the Dharma looks like, you people in this room. Take that responsibility seriously. And at the same time, we are held and maintained by that Dharma. We allow ourselves to be shaped by it. It's not just we're shaping it, but that we allow ourselves to enter into that form and structure and let it work on us, let it transform us. Often at the beginning of a long sesshin, I've used the metaphor of going into sesshin is like taking the first step on an escalator. All you do have to do is take that first step and let it carry you along. Be willing to be carried wherever it takes you and experience whatever happens along the way. We have to give ourselves over to an experience. And so giving ourselves over means that in some sense we pour ourselves into a pre-existing form. And while we're not in danger of trying to create a radical utopia that has the danger of becoming murderous, the downside in America is much more kind of deracinated free-for-all, a way in which cut off from the roots of tradition, cut off from the sense that these things are givens, feeling like now we can do whatever we want, we end up with a place like Omega, with 1,000 different workshops and teachers and forms, each in themselves may be very interesting or valuable, but in total a kind of unregulated hodgepodge. So it's a funny thing about this practice. We're trying to make it available, make it in some sense convenient so you can get here and do it. But in another sense, it's not supposed to be too convenient. It's supposed to be inconvenient in some way. It's supposed to be something you have to sacrifice something to participate in. You have to sometimes make tough decisions about what you're going to give up in order to give the time to this practice. It's supposed to be a challenge and a conflict and a difficulty that you face and take seriously. So I ask you, think about the responsibility you have to hold and maintain this practice and keep it going. And at the same time, what would really make it work in your life? What's the best way to bring this practice into your everyday life? that really is the mission of a place like this.